Hey there, students of Digital Humanities 306 at Merrillhurst. This is Kathy Inman-Behrens. I'm going to be talking with you today about Tara McPherson's essay, Why Are the Digital Humanities So White? This essay appears in Debates in the Digital Humanities, edited by Matt Gold, and I know that it's one of your required texts for the class. I'm teaching this in the context of electronic literature, which is to say, we spent time last week thinking about ways that the poetry generator House of Leaves of Grass creates an infinite canvas, an infinite scroll that we could never actualize as humans, that we could never fully engage. And this week, I thought it would be interesting to think a little bit about Tara McPherson's productive analogy between the civil rights movement and the birth of Unix, and how those two slices of history co-constitute each other, and what that would mean for us today in 2013. I want to begin by pointing you to page 143. I'm actually looking at the book, although you're most welcome to go to the open source and open comment debates in DH site on the web. But here I am in papers pointing you to page 143. What if this very incompatibility, that is to say, between the discourses of race and the discourses of computation, is itself part and parcel of the organization of knowledge productions that operating systems like Unix help to disseminate around the world? Might we ask whether there's not something particular to the very forms of electronic culture that seems to encourage just such a movement, a movement that partitions off race from the specificity of media forms? Put differently, might we argue that the very structures of digital computation develop at least in part to cordon off race and contain it? Further, might we come to understand that our own critical methodologies are the heirs to this epistemological shift? One thing that McPherson is saying is that we're all implicated and complicitous in this move, and that even something as seemingly benign as a software program itself is born of an ideology and expresses an ideology and extracts from us as users a performance of that ideology. Although what those ideologies mean can be shifting depending on the context, and we'll talk a little bit about that as we move through the essay. But I think it's that notion that there really is nothing neutral about our engagement with the computer, and that she asks, how is it possible that our own cultural racism, our own sexism, can't inform how such systems are designed? Now, a clever sounds so belittling. A really smart graduate student of Ryan Cordell's asked in a blog post that I linked to in our schedule. This post is called "On McPherson's Critique of the Uncritically Situated Code of Neutrality in Digital Humanities Practice." I linked to that on our schedule, and this graduate student rightly asks, you know, aren't we really just finding an interesting association between the birth of the civil rights movement and the birth of Unix, and suggesting that the birth of Unix and its emphasis on modularity, which is to say that bits of code could be excised from the whole, that the principle of modularity, in fact, is that you don't have to take the whole thing down. You can take out just one piece of it and have that, you know, possibly difficult bit removed. Can't we think of that, McPherson would ask, in the context of race? And, you know, can't we have these difficult agitators demanding civil rights removed from the mainstream culture in the most frightening way? Of course, that would refer to the assassinations of Martin Luther King Jr. and Robert Kennedy in the 1968, the assassinations of Malcolm X in 1965, and the burning of Watts. You know, couldn't all of these agitations be removed from culture, a culture that would structure computation as modular, specifically so that little things could be excised? Now, a programmer would say, wait a second, modularity, there are very good reasons for modularity to exist. It happens to be a very efficient way to execute codes, you know, execute the human intention, to translate the human intention into a machinic performance, the simple parts will connect to, or will be connected by clean interfaces, and that clarity is better than cleverness. But McPherson finds these things ideologically freighted. And I think, you know, just skipping way ahead in the essay, I think that she has a really good point. In other words, even if Ryan Cordell's graduate student, who I believe is unnamed, I'm looking for the author's name on this post and I don't see it, even if the graduate student sort of modestly says things like, I'm just wondering, if her argument is persuasive to her audience, but that there's no real evidence of actual facts, like that graduate student, I find the I find McPherson's coupling of these two historical moments to be a very productive frame, but insufficiently fortified with evidence to show any kind of causality. What she's saying is that the studying of race and gender may divert us from the study of capital, that if we were to just study these things as themes, that's insufficient, that in fact racism and sexism are encoded at the machinic level, and that our job as scholars of the humanities is to move beyond the dancing images on the screens to understand the processes by which such images and themes are produced digitally. But like this graduate student, I think that although there's a really beautiful parallel logic that racism and the wish to excise bits of social agitation is akin to modularity and our wish to create fragmentary knowledges that can be excised at will, I don't really see evidence for that inside of this essay. Let me be clear, says McPherson on page 149. By drawing analogies between shifting racial and political formations and the emerging structures of digital computing in the late 1960s, I'm not arguing that the programmers creating Unix at Bell Labs and in Berkeley were consciously encoding new modes of racism and racial understanding into digital systems. Indeed, many of these programmers were themselves left-leaning hippies, and the overlaps between the counterculture and early computing culture run deep, as Fred Turner has illustrated. But instead, she is, quote, highlighting the ways in which the organization of information and capital in the 1960s powerfully responds across many registers to the struggles for racial justice and democracy that so categorized the United States at the time. Many of these shifts were enacted in the name of liberalism, aimed at distancing the overt racism of the past, even as they contained and cordoned off progressive radicalism. The emergence of covert racism and its rhetoric of colorblindness are not so much intentional as systemic. Computation is a primary delivery method of these new systems, and it seems at best naive to imagine that culture and computational operating systems don't mutually infect each other. Now, ordinarily we wish for stronger evidence than it seems naive to think that these things aren't related. And I teach you this essay and I ask you to read this essay because I think that McPherson is right that these things ought to be associated and thought through. But I also raise your awareness to the fact that the essay does not demonstrate conclusively that this productive association manifests itself in particular operations. Rather, it operates more at the imaginative level, in which we understand that ideology moves through a series of interactions between human and machine, and that those interactions are structured by humans, written by humans, who themselves might be retreating from a frightening cultural moment of social upheaval. In fact, I've thought this myself for a long time, that when you think about the evolution of deconstruction, it began as a retreat. Formalism began as a retreat from precisely the kinds of social unrest of the 1960s, that moving from New Criticism, which, citing the work of Christopher Newfield, McPherson calls managerial. You know, that, in other words, the mid-20th century mode of literary analysis was to say, let's look at the object as in and of itself. Let's decontextualize it. Its historical situation isn't interesting. The author's intention doesn't tell us anything. What we're looking at is just the object as it operates formally. But formal analyses are not only cold because they're stripped of human reception and creation and so forth, but they're also inaccurate because, of course, any system, anything that's made, does reflect, even at the level of code, the sorts of orientations, biases, ideologies, wishes operant at the time. And so it's quite possible that, you know, the move from new historicism, new criticism into deconstruction was a retreat. That emphasis on formalism was a retreat from Cold War and then civil unrest. But then what McPherson is arguing, and this is why she's asking, why are the digital humanities so white, is it possible that the very systems by which we perform our interpretations and readings, that is to say through the digital, is it possible that the system itself is so infected by racism that it can't help but be complicit in the production of what she calls a lenticular view? Now, recently I was in Los Angeles and I was at the Getty Museum where there was an exhibit called Overdrive, and they had these beautiful stereoscopic views of 1950s diners, and so period-specific stereoscopic views. So think about those little viewfinders that you hold up to your eyes and you click it, and it puts an image, a stereoscopic image, in place for you, and it shows 3D. And, you know, looks. And what's interesting about those stereoscopic images is that they're all integrated. All the layers are integrated sufficiently that it's always the same image. A lenticular image, by contrast, is one that has similar sorts of layering, but those bits are modular. You can't actually integrate them into one view. You can see different bits of it from different angles, but they don't cohere into one integrated view, as do the stereoscopic images. So when she says that the way code works is lenticular, she's suggesting that it's modularity. It's the little bits all working together, but the capacity that certain kinds of knowledge could be excised from the field of view. It's lenticular because one particular mode or node could be taken out if for some reason it was deemed non-functional. And that analogy between how bits of history get excised and how bits of code can get excised in the name of ease, simplicity, clarity, functionality, that is a powerful ideological operation between how we work culturally and how the objects that we make in code and through the digital are themselves reflections of that culture. So there are other assigned readings for you to review for this week. You remember that we're looking primarily at Christine Wilkes's Underbelly and also her piece Out of Touch, which was commissioned by the San Francisco Museum of Modern Art for the Third Hand Played series, curated by Brian Kim Stephans, himself a very distinguished visual poet, electronic literature artist, and professor at UCLA. This work, Underbelly, is one of Wilkes's best-known pieces. It was published in 2010, and it won the New Media Writing Prize in 2010. And it is really quite a beautiful work. I guess what I want us to think about as we talk together on Thursday is, to what extent is it possible to perform our different identities in digital space? As you know, we're experimenting with tweeting from different perspectives, yet you get to invent a fictional character or a non-human character or a non-human being or whatever it is, and then tweet from that perspective. What we're playing with is, well, we're using the McPherson work in order to frame how knowledge gets produced per se, and then the important piece that the electronic literature is prompting us to think about is to what extent can playable media fiction help us bridge the worlds between what's possible digitally and what's representative of our own identities, our own aspirations, and the human. This piece, Underbelly, is about a woman sculptor who is actually her sister. It's actually Christine Wilkes' sister, carving on the site of a former colliery, a coal mine, in the north of England. As this sculptor carves, she's disturbed by a medley of voices, some from the site's dark industrial past, and the player reader is plunged into an underworld of repressed fears and desires. You know, what I find so fascinating is the representation of bodies, and this is something that Ilya Szyslak talks about in her post in the Huffington Post, about the way that Wilkes always... That Wilkes's work is very interested in human embodiment. I'm really engaged by her work called Rememory, which is a literary game about dementia. And she finished the game shortly after the death of her father. He died of dementia. So what I like so much about Christine Wilkes's work is the way that it moves between, it uses the personal as a starting point for these really fascinating interrogations of, I don't know, the parameters of a lived life and how such lives can be performed in interactive art. You know, in other words, our engagement with it is so crucial to Underbelly, right? I mean, Underbelly, it's written in Flash, and so the whole thing is laid out for us. You don't actually control the outcome of Underbelly so much as choose your sequence through it. But then something like Out of Touch is completely fascinating to me. I mean, for me, I think about it as a commentary on the iOS, you know, that in this era where the it was published in August 2011, it was really born, it was created in the era of the beginning of smartphones. And I just think that's such a fascinating juxtaposition. So I suppose that's what I'd like you to think about as you work through our readings for Thursday. I look forward to talking with you then.